Matva. Thinking. Tam. Utkala. Jadam.
Without intelligence.
Unmatam. Mad. Kula vridaha.
The elderly members of the family.
Samantrinaha.
With the ministers.
Vatsaram.
Vatsara.
Vupatim.
Ruler of the world.
Chakrahu.
They made.
Yaveyangsam.
Younger.
Brahmehe.
A Brahmi.
Sutam.
Son.
Translation: for this reason, the ministers and all the elderly members of the family thought Utkala to be without intelligence and, in fact, mad. Thus, his younger brother, named Vatsara, the son of Brahmi, was elevated to the royal throne and he became king of the world. So, purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. It appears that although there was monarchy, it was not at all an autocracy. There were senior family members and ministers who could make changes and elect the proper person to the throne, although the throne could be occupied only by the royal family. In modern days also, whenever there is monarchy, sometimes the ministers and elderly members of the family select one member from the royal family to occupy the throne in preference to another. Okay. So, matvatam janam hunnatam kula vredha samantrinaha vatsaram bhupatim chakru yaviham sam brahme sutam. Okay. And so, Om Aganat Mirandasha. Gananjana shlakaya chakshur miritam yena tasmai shi gurvena mahat. So nowadays, we are very proud of our what's called democracy, or as Prabhupada said, democracy. And so actually we'll speak a little bit about that, a little bit about the monarchy. So there's a lot of topics in regard to this particular verse. So one thing is that generally in the monarchical system, you have this thing called primogeniture. Now that's a fancy word. So anyone know what that means? Primogenitor. That means basically genitor, like the word genitals, genitor, to be born, a gene. You ever heard of the word gene? That's not a boy's name, gene, you know. But it means the things, you know, the genes in the cell that actually determine, you know, what all your characteristics are, what your characteristics are. Of course, we know that you get certain genes because you have certain karma and certain desires. That's from another perspective. But anyway, there are genes. There's DNA and RNA. And so primogeniture means firstborn. That's really what it means, the firstborn of the king. So generally that person would become the next king. Now the reason for the hereditary conception, this is a very interesting thing. I got to be careful. I put my legs up, I'm going to end up falling over backwards again. Anyway, so if you don't like Bhagavatam class, you can just push the speaker off. So there's a reason why there was hereditary kings and, you know, princes and everything like that, because they knew about breeding. Breeding means that, you know, when you have certain parents, you produce like offsprings. Offspring means, you know, children. That's natural. It's like when someone's born, you say, isn't it generally when someone's a little baby's there, you say, he has your eyes, she has your nose. You know, you ever hear that before? I'm sure they do the same thing in Denmark. You know, many times, you know, oh, look at that cute little thing, you know. It has your toes or something like that on it. Or little Johnny looks just like his mommy. So there is truth in genetics. You know, we're not denying that, even though we're devotees. There's truth in genetics. We do deny, like, Darwinian theory of evolution. But the genes are just some arrangement by Krishna so that certain things will go on in this material world. I mean, it's a fact, just like, you know, even the demigods, they have certain children by genes, and the children generally are like the demigods, or at least like the psychology of the demigods, etc. So, therefore, there was a lot of interest in good breeding. Even nowadays, of course, they breed plants. Isn't it? There was one famous person in the United States named Luther Burbank. I don't know if you ever heard of his name. He was the first one like to breed plants, you know, so they would come up with different characteristics. And nowadays, of course, they have this genetic engineering. And you can buy food that's nice GMO food. You know what GMO food is? Genetically modified organism, GMO. So, and of course, you may be eating a tomato that has fish genes in it, just so it looks nice and shiny. No one's ever heard of this before? You've heard of this before. Anyway, so there's this conception of breeding. And even in Germany before World War II, you had Hitler, and of course he was a demon, we understand that, who was a believer in this thing called eugenics. Eugenics is a fancy word for breeding people. And it's interesting, his idea was to create a master race, supermensch, as they say in German, a master race by breeding who he considered to be, let's say, of a higher genetic status than others. And it's interesting also that he got his ideas from the UK and from America, if you look at the history. Because in America, they were actually forcibly sterilizing people who they thought could not be, or should not breed. Did you know about this before? So he actually read books written by, and I forget the author's names, the authors in America and also in the UK, about breeding people, and he got many of his concepts from there. Of course, he was a demon. We're not saying he was a nice guy, you know, and he didn't breed the right people. But in any case, there's this knowledge about breeding. So in the Vedic system, they wouldn't like forcibly sterilize people who they thought were unworthy to breed, but they would arrange for people to be married to other people so there would be proper offspring, and especially with the kings and the Brahmins. I mean, that's really why you had the system of people generally marrying in the same castes. Nowadays, it's become perverted. Like in India, they do also have a caste conception. And in some states, like Gujarat, they have literally hundreds of different castes that have nothing to do with someone's nature, but just something to do with the village relationships. Just like I have one friend from Gujarat, he was born in a caste called the Prajapati caste. Prajapati means, you know, someone who has children, basically. And his parents, they're always looking for someone to get married to him who was born in the Prajapati caste. And so they looked and looked, sent him to India a few times. He's actually in New Zealand. Sent him to India a few times. Finally, they found a girl of Prajapati caste and forced the guy to get married. You have to marry her because she's the same caste. And he was thinking, I don't like her. You know, at least he couldn't get along with her. And the parents said, you have to get married, you have to get married. And then so they just like tied him up and brought him to the marriage ceremony. And they asked, do you accept this so-called lady? You know, not so-called, she was a lady. It wasn't a sex change operation. But anyway, do you accept this lady as your wife? And they said to him, you know, probably a gun in the head. I do, you do, I do. And so he accepted. And then later on, it's interesting. I mean, Indian culture is interesting. Modern Indian culture is not really Vedic culture. So they forced him to get married, and later on after he got married, he didn't even want to speak to the lady. And then they brought in some sannyasi to preach to him, and the sannyasi said, unless you stay married to her and preach to her, and, you know, have a relationship with her and everything like that, you're going to go to hell. All your forefathers are going to go to hell. And you'll fall down from Krishna consciousness, you can become a demon, and poor guy is shaking like that, ready to commit suicide. So anyway, These things happen in modern Indian culture. I don't know if you ever heard about stuff like this before. Well, any case. But there was breeding that was considered between the different castes. And the castes were considered according to the nature, like Chaturvarna, Mayashrista, Guna, Karma, Vibhagasha. Someone was considered to be a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, according to his nature. And, you know, the Brahmanas examined the person's nature very, very carefully. Sometimes people ask me, how can you ascertain someone's nature? It's very easy. It doesn't take a lot of intelligence to see whether someone's a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. I mean, just put some money in front of them, and then if they go for it, they're a Brahmin. Just like when Drupada was testing the Pandavas after they had won Draupadi. He wanted to see, because the Pandavas were in hiding. They were making believe they were Brahmanas. Of course, they weren't Brahmanas. They looked like, they were dressed as Brahmanas, but they looked like Rambo, you know, big muscles. Can you imagine some big Brahmana comes into the, you know, someone comes in with a Brahmin thread and he looks like Vidvid or Gorilla or something like that, you know, really big. Muscular. I'm a Brahmin. He said, are you a Brahmin? So he wanted to test to see what they actually were, so he put out the implements for each of the different varnas. He put out, you know, swords and bows and arrows for Kshatriyas. He put out books for Brahmanas. He put out, you know, I guess the plow for the Vaishyas or some money for the Vaishyas and some, you know, hammer and nails or something for the Shudras. And so the Kshatriyas immediately, that is the Pandavas immediately, went for the Kshatriya stuff. And he said, oh, you Kshatriyas, I understand. And they said, yes, we're the Pandavas. And they revealed who they were. So it's easy to ascertain, to understand what someone's nature is. It doesn't take a lot of brains. You know, people ask that question all the time, but it doesn't take a lot of brains. So people are married according to with people of a similar nature. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. You know, like the poor lady is, she wants to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, like that. And the man is thinking, you know, let's go to the disco. Or vice versa. You know, it just doesn't work. You have to have people with the same nature. That way, there's some compatibility. And that way, you know what you're going to end up with as far as children are concerned. Incidentally, Prabhupada said, as far as the Westerners are concerned, we're of mixed castes of unknown origin. So with the Prabhupada stated that. So with the children of the Western devotees, you don't know what you're going to come up with. It's like rolling the dice. It's like, what do they call it, snake eyes? You ever heard of that before? No, you know, when you roll the, that means two ones on the dice. You don't know, you know, it's like gambling. You may come out with a devotee, you may come out with a Brahmin, you may come out with a Rakshasa, you never know. So because we're mixed castes, we have just all these genes. I mean, if you actually do this thing called roots, I mean, you trace out our genetic heritage. In my genes, for example, they do come from Europe, so I'm one of you. So anyway, so you trace out our genetic heritage. I mean, actually, the Australians, we have one Australian here, the Australians are descendants generally of criminals. Did you know that? Not that you are. Because what happened is that England decided it wanted to send all of its criminals somewhere. So it thought, oh, there's this big island in the Pacific. So it took all the criminals and just shipped them there. And then, that's why it's so wild in Australia. Isn't it? Anything goes there. I mean, it's like, huh? It's just unbelievable. But, you know, it's good for Krishna consciousness. Because people are ready to accept anything and everything there. Like there was this one TV report, I don't know if any of you saw it, it was on the internet, about this wild Australian sports guy who went into the Hare Krishna movement for a week. Or something like that, shaved his head, you know. Anyway, he was ready for anything. Didn't become a devotee, started eating meat right afterwards. But that's Australia. So anyway, so the genes do mean something. So breeding is very important. So the kings would take their children and arrange marriages in such a way. Of course, the children weren't forced to get married to certain people. This thing called Swayamvara basically means that the girl would choose. She had the right of refusal. It's not that, you know, whoever won her, she was just like the gold medal in the Olympics. You know, there's some competition. You know, like Arjuna was shooting through the revolving wheel and the fish up there. Fish's eye like that. So it's not that, you know, here's your prize, and she had no choice. But she had a choice. She had the ability to say no. Like in the Swayamvara Draupadi, even Karna tried to compete. Draupadi said no. And they had to respect. And of course, she had a good reason for it. And Krishna also told her, you know, he said, you know, he's not the guy for you. Those other guys are for you. So it was ascertained, like, who is actually qualified to breed with someone else. Well, someone may say, that's weird. You know, why not a love marriage? Well, you know, the so-called love marriage, that's what's called in India, love marriage, you know, where people are speaking to each other. Many times you end up with people with different dispositions, and it's really not a good combination, and the children come out really weird from the combination. Because when people fall in love, this is for you brahmacharis, you got two of you here. But anyway, so when people fall in love, it's the same thing as, physiologically, that is, you know, brain scan-wise, it's the same thing as someone who's taking cocaine. Did you know that? Now it's something for you to know. That when two people fall in love, it's the brain looks the same if they take a scan, you know, brain scan, as someone who is snorting cocaine. And that means they don't have much judgment. They probably have no judgment. So, you know, they just look at each other's eyes and they don't consider the future, you know, what's going to happen, who's going to make money, you know, everything like that. Nothing practical. No practical considerations. Because then 6 months later, you know, they find out who they're married to or who they're living with, and they say, oh my God. Ugh, like that. So, therefore, that's the reason for arranged marriage, but it's not forced marriages. So this would be done. Then, the person, as I said, would have a right of refusal, saying no. They get married, and then they have children. But then the children were also examined to see, especially in the case of Brahmins or Kshatriyas, to see if they were actually qualified to fulfill the particular duties of their varna. They were actually given examinations. Actually, there's one interesting story in the Upanishads, and I forget the Brahmin's name. But anyway, there was a young man who was born in a Shudra family, actually less than Shudra family. He was born from a prostitute. This is a famous story in the Vedic literatures. And he wanted to become a Brahmana. So he went to his guru and he said, my dear Gurudev, I want to become your disciple, I want to become a Brahmana. And the guru said, all right, but who is your father? Because you could generally ascertain things according to the father. So he went back to his mother and said to his mother, who's my father? And his mother said, I don't know. How am I going to know, you know? Could have been him. And she lost track. And then he went back to his guru, and the guru asked him, so what'd your mother say? And he said, she doesn't know who my father is. And then the guru said, you're a Brahmin, because you're telling the truth. You know, most people wouldn't tell the truth. They would just make up some story. So it was understood according to one's nature. So with the kings, which is what's being discussed here, the son would actually be examined to see if he was worthy to be the next king. And there were many reasons why he wouldn't be worthy. I mean, one would be, like in the case here, that he was mad. Had no judgment. Mad here means has no judgment, basically. And of course, foolish, in the last verse, it says, foolish, blind, dumb, deaf, and mad. Although he wasn't so. He actually, this is also very interesting. He was absorbed in Brahman. Sometimes devotees do that, so the parents won't occupy them. They come to the Hare Krishna temple and the parents say, well, you want to go into business? And they go, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And the parents say, you're dumb and mad. And actually, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakura did this when Subhash Chandra Bose went to him and said, you know, give us some of your people to fight in this independence war. And he said, look at these Brahmacharis, they're too weak. They can't do anything. You know, you don't want any of these people. You want some of the most strong people like that. And then Subhash Chandra Bose was satisfied. So this Utkalahi acted mad. And so therefore, they thought, you know, better to name his younger brother. So that's one of the reasons if one's mad. Another reason if one has some bodily defect. Like in the case, can anyone think of an example? I can't, but anyone think of a particular individual who had a bodily defect who could become king? Yeah. Dhritarashtra. Yeah, that's the famous example. He was blind, you know, spiritually and materially. And so a blind king, because the king had all these duties too. King had to lead the army and fight. He couldn't just like stay and operate these unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs, like they do now. You heard of them before? Like in the American Army now, they're actually training more pilots to sit behind joysticks at a computer than they are to fly actual airplanes. Why? Because they have these unmanned airplanes. They're called the Predator. You never heard of these things? Nobody's educated here. So then they had when they're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, they have these airplanes without anybody in them. They're remote control airplanes. And so they have these missiles that they fire at people. And also they do surveillance. So the people sit in Washington and operate them while the planes are flying in Afghanistan or Iraq. So this is modern warfare. And nowadays they're inventing more robots and things like that. I was just reading about a robot that's the size of a mosquito. Interesting. They have robots that'll look like mosquitoes. You know, you see a mosquito, but it has little camera eyes on it. And it's flying through the air and spying on the enemy. You can see a mosquito, it's actually the enemy's robot. So in the old days, I mean, warfare was quite different. It was based on chivalry, too. It wasn't just, you know, kill everybody in sight. It was the soldiers would fight the soldiers, and they understood if they passed away in the battle, they would, you know, at least go to the heavenly planets, as Krishna says in the Gita. So there were kshatriyas. Nowadays, the people who are fighting are basically shooters. Prabhupada commented on that during the Vietnam War, that they were drafting people, that means taking people into the army forcibly, who were not qualified to fight. They were just like shooters. Absolutely shooters. So they would shoot each other. Sometimes they'd shoot the captain instead of shooting the enemy. It's true. They would be in the trenches in Vietnam and they would all be smoking marijuana at the same time. These are not kshatriyas. I mean, kshatriyas drink, but not while they're in the battlefields. It's a little bit different. So there were certain requirements to be the king. Nowadays, like you see the king or in England, for example, also here you have a queen, right? So there's not really any consideration of qualifications. There's some qualifications, like if someone marries a commoner, you know, they get dethroned or something like that. I know it's like that in the UK. But it's just, I mean, they're just like what's called titular heads, which means they have no actual authority. They're just like, because everything is democracy nowadays. But in the old days, the kings actually meant something. They weren't absolute because they were checked by the balance of the brahmanas. You know, the brahmanas would see how they were acting, like in the case of King Vena, who I think was mentioned later on in this chapter. The brahmanas had the right to kill the king, get rid of the king, dethrone the king, or change the person who was in charge of the kingdom. So that's called monarchy. And the difference is, like Prabhupada talks about here, autocracy basically means there's no checks and balances. Someone is just like, I'm the boss, and whatever I say. And that's what we experience in the modern day. I mean, just for example, in the UK, they had Henry VIII. Henry VIII was an autocrat in addition to being a monarch. Henry VIII, everybody knows about Henry VIII? Well, maybe a little European education for you. Henry VIII is the founder of the Anglican Church. Anglican Church is a big church in England. Also in the United States, The Anglican Church is called the Episcopalian Church. I don't know if you have any of those people here in Denmark. Probably not. What's that?
No, not much.
Not much. So what happened is that Henry VIII, he was married to this lady called Anne Boleyn. No one's ever heard the history of this before? I mean, people should be aware of these things. I mean, especially in Europe. Anyway, he was married, and he wanted to get rid of his wife. But England was Catholic at that time. So what do you do if you can't get a divorce? Because Catholics originally couldn't get divorced. Still not supposed to, but they do anyway. So you kill her. So he thought, you know, I can't stand this wife, you know. Kill her. And so he ended up, I think it was like six wives or something. Some he killed, some he actually made his own church. And divorced. And the poor guy ended up dying from venereal disease, I believe. I don't remember the whole history. But, you know, really horrendous king. Horrendous king. So he's an autocrat, you know. He just decided, you know, let's make a new church. All right, this is the church of the country. We call it the Anglican Church. The reason I'm making the church is because I want to get a divorce. Intelligent, isn't it? And the people just said, yes, sir. Basically, they followed the king. Because the king, there was this theory in Europe called the divine right of kings. You've heard about this before? No. That was the theory. And also in Denmark was the same thing. And wherever you had kings, you know, there was a king. King in so many places. So that was the monarchy, which is an autocracy. And then also in some places in Europe, you also had another thing called aristocracy. You understand? Aristocracy, which means like the aristocrats, the people born in certain families, were the leaders of society. There's a remnant of that in Europe, in UK too. It's called, they have the House of Lords and the House of Commons. You heard of that? The Lords are like hereditary or titled people, you know, special people. And the Commons are just the common people. So that's called aristocracy. There's aristocracy, monarchy, autocracy. We're giving all these crossy names. Monarchy means the king, you know, king. Aristocracy means the rulers by the so-called high-class people. And there's another type that we have nowadays, and it's not democracy. I've got news for you all. We don't have democracy anywhere in the world. You may say, what is he talking about? Because, you know, we always think it's a democratic country. We elect things and everything like that. Well, the system we have now is called oligarchy. Oligarchy means basically a rule. And Prabhupada said the same thing, that it's a rule by the vices now. That means a rule by money. Because who gets elected is actually determined by, you know, the business interests in most of the world today. And actually, in Iran, for example, it's the so-called clergy, you know, the so-called religious people. As you probably have been hearing today about the revolution in Iran, you know, the students are revolting. But most of the Western world, it's actually the wealthy people who are controlling society. For example, in America, to run for the president of the United States, I mean, it costs upwards of $500 million or more to actually just run. I mean, that means you need money. You need a lot of money to run for the president. You need the backing of rich people. You need all this publicity. And then even if you become president, you have to deal with the business interests who are influencing the members of Congress. Congress is like the legislative assembly. And they spend literally billions of dollars a year to influence members of Congress. Every country is like that too. You know, it's called lobbyists. Do you ever hear that word before? Lobbyists? I'm sure you have that here in Denmark too. Every Western country has that. You know, the business interests, they actually have more buildings wherever the capital of the country is, they have more buildings in wherever it is than the government actually does. The lobbyists. And they go, they meet with members of the legislature. In every country, you know, sometimes you have a bicameral legislature or a unicameral legislature. That means one house or two houses. You know, that's a fancy name. And they meet with them and they influence them. They say, you know, really, if you want our support, you got to vote for this or not vote for that. So that's the system nowadays. And the people, in general, they're influenced by these business interests and also money interests. And if they're shudras, then they're just influenced by how good the candidate looks. You know, that's the problem. Like in the United States, we had this one president whose name Kennedy many years ago. And the reason he won the election was because he was a handsome guy, you know. They put him up against this other person called Nixon who was really ugly. You know, he looked like a dog, practically speaking. And they put this handsome guy, you know, up against, you know, there's no question. I mean, and like you see, even we have one state in the United States, California, where the person used to be a movie star before. Maybe you've heard of him before. Anyway, I'm not going to mention his name. And it's just like, you know, he's from Germany, actually. Austria, actually. He's from Austria. And he, you know, he was in this movie called The Terminator before. You ever hear that?
Yeah.
And he was elected just because, you know, he's strong. You know, people think he's going to terminate all their enemies. So, you know, people elect people for crazy reasons. But basically, you need the backing of the business interests. So that's really what democracy is. It's not really election by the people, of the people, or whatever like that. It's people are being manipulated by the business interests of the country. And so therefore, people are being exploited in many ways. But in the genuine system, you know, the Vedic system, the monarch, the king, would be so concerned with the welfare of the people, he would neglect his own happiness for the welfare of the people. Like you have Lord Ramchandra. Perfect example. Lord Ramchandra, he actually sent Sita away. Why did he send Sita away? I mean, he loved Sita. He was more attached to Sita than she would. I mean, basically, they're each equally attached. But basically, he did that for the welfare of the people. I mean, just see. Because the people were considered praja. That means those who were born. Not only people, but the animals in the kingdom too. Like Parikshit Maharaj, he was protecting the cow and the bull, in the story in the Bhagavatam, right? The bull was being beaten, standing on one leg and urinating. And this Kali was actually attacking them. Nowadays, the king, you know, if he found someone attacking the cow and the bull, the king would sit down and say, all right, let's eat, right? You know, when is, not prasadam, but, you know, when's the barbecue, the king would say. But in those days, the king actually protected all living entities. So that's really what a king is, or president, or whoever's in charge. It doesn't matter what you call them. They're interested in protecting everyone and neglecting their own happiness. And what you have today, in the guise of monarchy, oligarchy, autocracy, democracy, is exactly the opposite. People are interested in their own interests, and they're exploiting the people for various reasons. So, anyway, so see, these are some of the points that we can make about this verse and purport. So any questions or comments? I mean, we can speak about governmental systems for a long time, but not so applicable for Bhagavatam class. Questions? Yeah.
What would actually judge if a lady should have Swayambhara or the...
Sita is partially selected. But she had the right to say no. There was a test to see if the man was qualified, and then the lady could say no. That was the whole point. You know, first you have to see if the man's a bona fide kshatriya. I mean, of course, the test with Sita was something different because nobody could string that bow. I mean, nobody could actually take care of that bow. So it was actually arranged that Sita only wanted to marry Ram. And so it was Krishna, you know, Lord Ramchandra's arrangement that would happen. But basically the system was she had a right to say no. I mean, even when you have... you had Grandfather Bhishma, who kidnapped Amba, Ambalika, and Ambika. You know the story. The three girls, daughters of Kashi. And Amba actually said, no, I've already given my heart to Shalva. Remember that story? Or to Shalva. And Grandfather Bhishma said, all right, you go back to Shalva. But then, of course, Shalva didn't want to take her back. And then she went to Bhishma. Anyway, there's a whole story in the Mahabharata about that. But she had a right to say no. Because Bhishma actually kidnapped her for Vitrataviriya. And that was bona fide to kidnap girls for Kshatriyas to do that. It wasn't against the Dharma. I know the ladies don't like that, but anyway, it wasn't against the Dharma for Kshatriyas. And the ladies liked it. It was romantic. You know, can you imagine, you know, some big romantic guy kidnaps you? And he has a lot of money, too, so there's no problem. He has a lot of money, you don't have to work. And then, yeah, I mean, you get to be a princess. I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, even most of the people who were most of the ladies that were kidnapped by Ravana, they liked it. They were happy. Because Ravana had a curse. He couldn't touch a lady unless she actually voluntarily submitted. You know, one time he did it, he was cursed. It was Ramba, actually, he attacked. And then Nalakuvara, the famous Nalakuvara from the Manigriva Nalakuvara story, cursed him because he was her husband. And he cursed Ravana. He said, next time you even think about this or do something like that, you're going to die immediately. So even most of Ravana's harem means like a lot of girls, you know, thousands, millions, most of them whom he kidnapped actually were really liked because Ravana was a handsome chap. I mean, any lady would love to be married to Ravana. Almost. I mean, he was... And eat you. And eat you for breakfast. But no, he didn't do that to anyone else. But the rest of them, they submitted voluntarily. He wouldn't have eaten her. He was in love. He was just threatening. But Ravana was a good guy. Actually, he was one of Jayan Vijay, so he's a devotee. So, but, you know, it's described in the Ramayana that they gladly accepted Ravana. You know, he kidnapped these young girls, and they just thought, wow, here's a husband, you know. And so when Hanuman was trying to find Sita Devi, he went into the ladies' ashram, you know. It was actually called gymnasium. You have that word here? What does gymnasium mean here in this country?
High school.
But it actually comes from the word GYN, which refers to women, like gynecologist or something like that. So it was actually, in those days, it was gymnasium meant... In Sanskrit, it meant a place for women. It's interesting how the words change and the derivation of words. If you actually, you know, trace out, like, linguistically, etymologically, it's called. So Hanuman took a very small form. It was like a little bug, you know, the size of a bug. And he went to the place where all the women were, and he was flying around trying to find Sita Devi. And he was looking... Is that her? But all the ladies, they were drunk. It was like in the middle of the night, and all the ladies were lying around. Like, drunk, because they were all drinking. There were thousands of them. And Hanuman was thinking, I'm a brahmachari, what am I doing in this place? And then he remembered Lord Rama, and Lord Rama protected him. Because they're all very attractive ladies. Anyway, he's flying around. And then finally on the main bed, he saw Ravana with this very beautiful girl, and that was Mandodari, his wife. And they were both asleep, and Hanuman was thinking, let me kill the guy now. And then he thought, no, that's Ram's doing. Ram didn't tell me to kill him. He just said, find Sita. So I have to listen to Ram's order. I can't actually become more intelligent than Ram, or more intelligent than, think I'm more intelligent than his order. So anyway, so Ravana had many, many ladies, and they accepted him. Accept him. Generally, the ladies accept it. You know, you have some, like, handsome man, I mean, basically you fall in love with him. I mean, I don't know about that. I'm not a lady, but I'm not going to ask you all. But now it's different, you know, and now it's different. I mean, Ravana was in charge practically of the whole heavenly kingdom and everything. I mean, I wouldn't mind marrying Ravana if you get the whole Lanka, you know. You can get whatever you want, as many computers as you want, things like that. Pretty good, isn't it? Pretty good deal. Because you don't get Krishna. That's the only thing missing. Only one little thing missing. Like Prabhupada said, you have a bunch of zeros, and there's no one. It's just zero. So it's like that in Ravana's kingdom. You have many, many zeros, but no Krishna. So anyway, any other questions or comments about this? You know, some interesting facts about government. Yeah.
I'm thinking, it's crazy how I can't remember the name, Srimati Radharani in Mathura.
Well, Srimati Radharani in Mathura, you mean who she became in Mathura? In Dwarka, you mean?
In Dwarka.
In Dwarka, she became Satyabhama.
Jarasandha
had arranged for Sisu, you know, actually, no, Rukmi arranged for Sisupal to marry Rukmini. Is that what you're thinking about? Yeah. But Rukmi's father, was a Rukmakesh, he wanted her to marry Krishna. But Rukmi had a different idea.
So he would not choose.
She was choosing. She wrote a letter. No. But she would have definitely said no, you know, or she would have killed herself or something like that. I mean, there's no way that Rukmini would have accepted Shishupal. You know, what is meant for the lion should not become taken by the jackal. That's what she wrote to Krishna in the letter. So, no, she could have refused. That was the system. The Swayamvara basically means, the word means, she chooses. She chooses. So she had a right to say no. Of course, there was like the Indian social pressure too, you know. How can you refuse? You know, the brother, if your brother is saying her brother was Rukmi, and she loved her brother too. It's not that she hated her brother. Because when Krishna was getting ready to kill her brother, she said no. She said no, and then Krishna gave him a haircut. You know the story? Krishna got chopped off a little hair there, a little hair there, a little hair there. Like in Denmark here. You've seen people like that, right? What's that called when the hair sticks up straight? A spiky. So he gave him a spike haircut. With his sword. Didn't even use a razor, you know. Used his sword and chopped off a little hair. So, but she loved him. So out of brotherly love, she... You know, I'm not saying she would have accepted because she was attached to Krishna, but there was that pressure. Indian families are interesting because there's a lot of pressure within the families and guilt. I've seen people, I'm not talking about Rukmini's family, but in general, nowadays people commit suicide and everything like that because they're pressured to do something that they don't want to do. Or there was one famous, there was actually a famous cartoon that I just saw where an Indian family, I'm trying to remember all the details. Oh yeah, so the son got his grades from school, and he got all A's except for one B. And the father was really angry. My son got a B. You know, I can't stand it. And, you know, so-and-so got A's. And he was yelling and screaming at his wife. And the wife said, but he's been accepted in Harvard, you know, a big university. And then the husband said, no, I don't care. I don't care, you know. And the wife says, well, he's going to graduate soon, you know, get his bachelor's degree. And the husband said, well, someone else's son is going to get a doctorate, you know, PhD. And he says to his wife, why can't he get a doctorate? And then they look at the picture of the boy sitting there. He said, because he's only 11 years old. Jai, Shishi, Gordon, and Tai. So, I mean, I deal with people from India all the time. And you see, the culture now is not actually the original Vedic culture. It's a mixture of the Muslim culture, Western culture. You know, it's like a whole brew, witch's brew of different cultures. And a lot of the things that we think are Indian or Vedic culture actually come more from the Muslims than they do from, you know, the actual original Vedic culture. So we have to be able to distinguish between them. I mean, I hear this all the time, you know, this Indian culture. Prabhupada did not come to teach Indian culture. He came to teach the original Vedic culture in Krishna consciousness. And we find many people go, you know, devotees go to India and they take up Indian culture instead of Krishna consciousness. It's really, we have to be able to differentiate between the two, yeah.
What is left of good things?
What is left of good things? The things Prabhupada taught us. And the thing, you know, there's a lot of ritualistic stuff. I mean, I'm going to be giving a course this summer on the whole history of India. And there's this interesting things that, you know, that occurred even before the Muslims invaded or anyone invaded India, how the Brahmanas, they came up with all these rituals just to make themselves exclusive so that they would make more money, which is interesting. And then as a result of that, doing that, you had people who broke away from the Vedic culture, like the Buddhists and the Jains. And then people who went to the forests, you know, broke away, the Aranyakas. Anyway, there's a whole history which I don't have time to talk about right now. But, so the Brahmanas, just to talk about a little bit of ritualism, got into all these little rituals, these details. Like even in ISKCON, sometimes we're influenced by that, like what spoon to use when you're doing a fire sacrifice. Use the spoon with, you know, the fingers, or the spoon that's a spoon, or the spoon that's this way and that way. You know, I can't even understand these things. Prabhupada said if you want to understand these things, ask his god brothers. You know, because Prabhupada, you know, what Prabhupada taught us was the actual pure bhakti. Now, in many cases, you have Vaishnavas who present bhakti in using the rituals because you're preaching to a certain culture. Like Prabhupada said, the Hari Bhakti Vilas was influenced by the ritualistic Brahminical culture because they were trying to preach to people in that culture. Prabhupada did things sometimes for preaching purposes. Like in Vrindavan, when he installed Krishna Balaram, and of course Radha Shyam Sundar and Gauranatai, he had the ritualistic Brahmanas do the installation, but Prabhupada actually said it was the Harinam that brought the deities or called Krishna to appear in that way. So you have to understand that. So sometimes devotees take very seriously the ritualistic aspect. I mean, for example, one thing that's mentioned is don't eat carrots. That's a ritualistic statement. And so the devotees sometimes were criticized by other, you know, Gaudiya Matha organizations. Why are you eating carrots, you devotees? Because there's some ritualistic injunction against. But you see, Prabhupada ate carrots. Even on Ekadasi, Prabhupada made carrot halva for the devotees. So we have to understand those particular injunctions are meant for dealing with ritualistic people. So they'll be attracted, or they'll take us seriously. They won't take us seriously. So when you're in India, you know, when I'm in India, I follow a different set of rituals, you know, external rituals, than I would in the West. Because, you know, I'm dealing with different people. That's all. But I'm always chanting, I'm always, you know, going to the morning program and everything like that. So, you know, preaching means sometimes adapting I mean, it's like here in the West, like if someone comes up to you and you're on the street and they want to shake your hand, you shake their hand. Doesn't, when you're in Sankirtan, you don't go, when you're in Sankirtan distributing books, you don't go to everybody like this, do you? I don't think so. I mean, they're going to think, this guy's weird. And you know, on the street, you don't say, please accept my obeisances. All glories to Prabhupada. You say, how do you do? My name is, you know, whatever your name is. So you just presentation according to the culture. Or like if you have a restaurant here or anywhere in the West, sometimes you prepare Western vegetarian preparations, like, you know, veggie burgers or something like that. So, you know, so to bring people, the whole point is whatever brings people to Krishna consciousness. But the essence of Krishna consciousness is, you know, the chanting, the five important principles of Vedic, mentioned in the nectar of devotion, like living in a holy place, chanting the holy names, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, associating with devotees like that, worshipping the deities, the five important principles. So, you know, that's mentioned by Srila Rupa Goswami in the nectar of devotion, the bhakti, sadhana bhakti principles. So we have to be able, under the instruction, guidance, example of Prabhupada, to be able to differentiate, understand what's essential and what's not essential. Otherwise, you could become caught up in all these rituals and you won't get to chanting Hare Krishna. I remember one time, many, many years ago, I think when Prabhupada was present, I was in a temple, staying in a temple, it was a sannyasi, and I was sharing the bathroom with someone else who was really into the rituals. And so I woke up in the morning, you know, I wanted to take a shower, and then after an hour, he's still in the shower. And I'm thinking, huh, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm calling the Ganges, you know. You know, he's doing all the mantras in the bathroom, which you're not really supposed to do anyway, but you know, he wanted to take a bath in the Ganges, so he had to do the whole Ganges, you know, Sahasranama or something like that in the bathroom. And then there I was, you know, in a gumsha, and I wanted to go to Mangalarti. So there's a, you know, anyway, that's a funny example, but that's really, you know, far off example, far out example. But these things happen.
I was also thinking about that, like we heard that the deity worship is like you really understand the prayers that you say, and I just started recently how to base our insights, and there are so many mantras actually, but the question is
Manasa Seva, yeah. Whatever prayer that you're reciting, you should remember what it means when you're doing. Because if you're just reciting it ritualistically, it's not going to be so beneficial. Then it's Niyamagraha. Isn't it? I think you all study Upadeshamrita. Isn't it? Niyamagraha. There's Niyamagraha. Niyamagraha. Niyamagraha means you're doing the things, but you're really not conscious of it. It's just ritualistic. It's ritual. You're not thinking of the goal, you're not thinking of why you're doing it. You're just doing it. So, and then with deity worship too, it's like that. I mean, you can do it. All the mantras are fine. I mean, wonderful mantras. And they're beautiful mantras too. But why not think of the meaning as you're doing it? I mean, it's good for the devotees to learn a little Sanskrit. I mean, basically after a few years in the movement, hopefully when you read a Sanskrit verse, you understand. I mean, I don't know grammar or anything like that in Sanskrit, but when I read a verse, I can understand what it's saying. Basically, I know most of the important words in Sanskrit. So, yeah, and if you read the, actually, if you read Prabhupada's books and read the word-by-word translations, you'll understand enough about the mantras, so when you recite them, you'll understand the meaning of them. That helps, too. Devotees should learn a little basic Sanskrit like that. I mean, otherwise, why would Prabhupada put the word-by-word translations or transliterations or anything like that in there? I'm not saying you have to learn Devanagari or anything like that, but at least, you know, some basic things. When someone says Krishna, you understand what that means. That's Krishna. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And maybe a little grammar. Bhagavate is different than Bhagawan. Bhagawan means God. Bhagavate means unto Bhagawan. It's like unto. Certain basic things. I'm not saying you go through the whole grammar book. Most of us can't go through the whole grammar book and learn Sanskrit grammar because that takes a whole lifetime. It takes a genius and a whole lifetime. But certain things like Bhagavate unto Bhagavan, isn't it? That says it. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva. I offer my obeisances unto Bhagavan Krishna, who is the son of Vasudeva. So there's Vasudeva and Vasudeva. Vasudevaya means the son of, unto the son of Vasudeva. That's Vasudeva and Devaki. Okay? I think we have to end, right? Time for everyone to go on Sankirtana, at least the Prasadam. Okay, all glories to the divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, ki jai.